Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., John Russell, and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a new project in India and Uganda is aimed at helping health workers save the lives of mothers and babies with information from electronic devices. The $100 million project is funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, the World Bank, and other groups. Officials plan to extend the project to a total of 10 countries. The goal is to prevent the premature deaths of 6 million women and children by 2030. Raj Shah is president of the Rockefeller Foundation, which leads the project. The group is providing $60 million of the $100 million total cost. Shah said the plan is to give health workers low-cost tools to help them gather the information they need to help communities and families most at risk. The project will provide tools such as real-time risk maps to help health workers reach mothers and children. Workers also will be able to study non-health data on climate or social media patterns to predict and prepare for local disease outbreaks or health emergencies. Shah told Reuters, "A few years ago, these community health workers had no real technology. Today, the vast majority of them have smartphones with data and software technologies in their hands, and with those, we can help them do their work better." A UN report published last week stated that more women and newborn babies survive now than ever before. But the report said that a baby or a pregnant woman still dies every 11 seconds somewhere in the world. Deaths of mothers are nearly 50 times higher for women in sub-Saharan Africa than in wealthy countries. The report also found that babies in sub-Saharan Africa are 10 times more likely to die in their first month of life.
American colleges and universities are fast becoming training grounds not only for members of the U.S. Olympic team, but Olympians from other countries. A recent example of this was at the National Collegiate Athletic Association Track and Field Championships in Austin, Texas. Among the many top athletes competing there, 230 came from countries other than the United States. Many of these athletes will face each other starting on Friday in events at the IAAF World Athletics Championships in Doha, Qatar. Clyde Hart directs the track and field program at Baylor University in Texas. Hart has worked with many Olympic champions at Baylor. We are the minor leagues for our track and field in this country to get to the next level, he said. College athletes are a big part of American success in winning medals at the Olympic Games. At the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, 176 medal winners came from U.S. college programs, the Associated Press reports. Most of these men and women came from big universities that belong to conferences, groups of schools that compete against each other. These conferences negotiate deals for television broadcasts of college football and basketball games. The TV deals provide them with hundreds of millions of dollars. That money is used, in part, to pay for other sports which do not earn a lot of money or actually lose money. Colleges outside of the major conferences often struggle to make money from their sports programs. Others are cutting sports. The number of men's gymnastics and wrestling teams, for example, has been decreasing for more than 20 years. The U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee recognizes the importance of its ties to the NCAA and college athletics programs. It is pushing for rule changes that will make it easier for track and field athletes to compete in college sports. Track and field is doing better at many colleges than most other sports. Numbers from the NCAA show that there were 286 men's teams and 338 women's teams in the top division of colleges in 2018. That is a slight increase over the last 10 years. Part of the reason, the AP reports, is that a U.S. law, known as Title IX, requires colleges to offer the same opportunities for women to play sports as for men. At the 2016 Summer Olympics, all but four of America's 129 track and field athletes were from NCAA programs. But U.S. colleges have also developed champions for other countries. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Imagine that you want to describe an experience. You want to talk about how you perceived something. In other words, what you saw, heard, or felt. In our report today, we will explore the grammar of perception. Specifically, we will explore what grammar experts might call verbs of perception. These are words that describe actions related to our senses, seeing, hearing, and listening, for example. Betty Azar is an expert on English grammar. In her book, Understanding and Using English Grammar, she notes that English speakers often use verbs of perception before two other verb forms, the simple form and the form ending with ing.
Azar adds that the two verb forms that follow verbs of perception can sometimes have a similar meaning. As an example, let us consider a line from a famous movie, 2001, A Space Odyssey. In the film, a computer named Hal says the following words.
Abe, although you took very thorough precautions in the pod against my hearing you, I could see your lips move.
In this example, the verb see is the verb of perception. The simple form of the verb move follows it. Although Hal said, I could see your lips move, it could have said, I could see your lips moving. The two statements are close in meaning. Here is another example. Imagine a police detective is investigating a crime. The detective might ask people questions like,
Did you see anything strange last night?
I saw a man run down the street.
Here, the witness used the verb of perception, see, as well as the simple form of the verb run. But their exchange could have been somewhat different, as we hear in this example.
Did you see anything strange last night?
I saw a man running down the street.
In this case, the ing form of the verb comes after the verb of perception. The first and second exchanges with the police detective are close in meaning. However, at other times, there is a clear difference in meaning when English speakers use the ing form after a verb of perception, as we will find.
Sometimes English speakers use the ing form after a verb of perception to point out that an activity is taking place when it was perceived. Here is an example. The following statements are about the American actor and humorist Dave Chappelle.
I saw Dave Chappelle perform a new act last week.
When I walked into the comedy club, I saw Dave Chappelle performing a new act.
In both statements, see is the verb of perception. In the first statement, the verb perform appears in its simple form. In the second statement, the verb perform appears in its ing form. In the first sentence, I saw Dave Chappelle perform a new act last week, the speaker gives the idea that she listened to all of Chappelle's new act from beginning to end. In the second one, when I walked into the comedy club, I saw Dave Chappelle performing a new act, the speaker gives the idea that she entered the room when Chappelle was already performing. In other words, the speaker did not see the beginning of Chappelle's act.
In the examples we presented today, we only used the verb of perception, see. Other common verbs of perception include hear, feel, watch, and notice. So one could say,
Last night, I heard a strange sound come from the closet.
Or,
Last night, I heard a strange sound coming from the closet.
If you wanted to point out that an action was already taking place, you could say, for example, When I woke up, I noticed my dog snoring loudly next to me.
Today we showed you how English speakers use either simple forms or ing forms after verbs of perception. We showed you that sometimes the two forms have a similar meaning. At other times, they have a clear difference. The situation can give you an idea of the speaker's meaning. While this subject might seem difficult at first, you will quickly learn it with practice. The next time you are watching English language movies or television shows, record examples of how the speakers use verbs of perception. You might hear them use these verbs in regular, repeated ways. I'm John Russell.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In 1796, the new nation held its third presidential election. George Washington won the first two elections without opposition. But 1796 saw a change in American politics. That year, for the first time, there was more than one candidate for president. There was also more than one political party. The Federalists were led by former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, and the Republicans were led by former Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. John Adams was a Federalist. Most people expected him to win. He was well known throughout the country. He had campaigned for American independence from Britain. He had served as a diplomat in Europe and as the first American minister to Britain. He was George Washington's choice for vice president and had served in that position for both of Washington's terms. But unlike other Federalists, Adams was not loyal to Alexander Hamilton. So Hamilton worked against Adams. Hamilton tried to win support for his own candidate for president. His choice was another Federalist named Thomas Pinckney from South Carolina. At last, the day arrived for counting the votes of the electors. The Federalists were shocked by the results. 71 electors voted for John Adams. 68 voted for Thomas Jefferson. Only 60 voted for Hamilton's choice, Thomas Pinckney. Under the electoral system used at that time, the candidate with the most electoral votes became president. The candidate with the next largest number of votes became vice president. So America's second president would be John Adams, a Federalist, and his vice president would be Thomas Jefferson, a Republican. Jefferson had resigned from public service a few years earlier, but he decided to accept his election as vice president. He wrote to his friend James Madison that he was willing to serve under Adams. Jefferson said he believed Adams was the only man who could stop Alexander Hamilton from becoming president in the next election in 1800. To Adams himself, Jefferson wrote that he valued their long friendship and hoped it would continue. Republican newspapers carried articles that were friendly to Federalist John Adams, the first time they had done so. Adams and Jefferson took office in March 1797. However, some Federalists believed their party's power had come to an end. Adams was a Federalist, but, as we said, he was not loyal to the party's leader, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, sitting in his law office in New York City, did not lose hope. He knew he still controlled the top Federalist leaders in Congress. More than that, he believed he knew how to control John Adams. The new president made Hamilton's job easy. Adams kept George Washington's top advisors. The three men who had served in Washington's cabinet would now advise President Adams. Washington had appointed them at Hamilton's request, and they always did what Hamilton told them to do. Historians still cannot explain why John Adams A man who did not like or trust Alexander Hamilton kept the three cabinet secretaries. If the secretaries had been men of great ability, then that might be an explanation. But they were not. One was a secretary of state who knew very little about foreign relations. The second was a secretary of the treasury who knew even less about finance. And the third was a secretary of war who knew nothing about military matters and defense. Adams may have kept these men as an act of party unity, or he may have kept them because he could not get anyone else. Whatever his reason, the decision was politically costly for Adams. The three cabinet secretaries worked together against him. President Adams would tell his cabinet secretaries what he wanted. Then they would secretly go to Alexander Hamilton for their orders. In the end, these secret activities helped destroy the Federalist Party. They also made the administration of John Adams one of the most important periods in the political history of the United States. John Adams was born in the village of Braintree, Massachusetts, in 1735. He wanted to be a farmer, but he was sent to Harvard College to study to be a clergyman. He had no interest in that career and became a lawyer instead. In the years before the American Revolution, John Adams wrote articles about the injustice of British rule. He also became a delegate to the First Continental Congress. He urged the Congress to appoint George Washington as commander-in-chief of the colonial armies. He argued for the creation of a navy, and he helped develop the resolutions declaring America's independence.
We think of George Washington in his famous farewell address urging Americans to give their loyalty to the United States, to further its interest and not to be loyal to some foreign country. And that was what Adams believed as well.
John Furling is a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia. He has written many books about America's founders, including John Adams. He says Adams wanted Americans to be able to govern themselves through their representatives.
Adams was opposed to monarchies, and he was opposed to rule by hereditary nobility.
Adams spent most of the Revolutionary War years in Europe. He helped win Dutch recognition of the new American nation. He also negotiated a loan from the Dutch government, as well as a treaty of friendship and commerce. After the Americans defeated British forces, he helped negotiate the peace treaty between the two countries. Then he served as the first American minister to Britain. Adams was extremely intelligent and was a thoughtful, lively writer. However, John Furling says, Adams often acted very coldly and said little, or he easily became angry.
If you thought of adjectives to describe Adams, certainly you would think of words like captious, contrary, gruff, egotistical, short-tempered, whatever.
But he says many people liked Adams after they got to know him.
He was certainly an excellent conversationalist, and he was filled with ideas, and he wasn't a vindictive person. He seemed to be a very honest person.
His best friend was probably his wife, Abigail. They were married for almost 60 years. Joseph Ellis, a history professor at Mount Holyoke College, wrote a book about their relationship.
They're the first power couple in American history. She has greater influence on policy than any first lady up until perhaps Eleanor Roosevelt.
Joseph Ellis says Abigail Adams did not see herself mainly as a hostess, even though she did lead social events. Instead, he says, the Adamses were a diplomatic team. Another of John Adams' supporters was Thomas Jefferson. This was strange. Jefferson's political philosophy was opposed to everything Adams represented. And the two men did argue, but they were also friends. For the last years of their lives, Adams and Jefferson wrote letters to each other about their memories and about the future of the country. Perhaps Jefferson liked Adams because he respected him for his intelligence. Perhaps he never forgot that Adams had fought hard for American independence. Adams had given many years of his life to the young nation. However, some people just did not like John Adams, but they knew they needed to work with him. Federalist leaders especially appealed to Adams' weaknesses when they wanted his support. For example, they knew Adams was jealous of George Washington. Sometimes, if Adams knew Washington's opinion on a subject, he would purposely offer a different opinion. Yet Washington, like Jefferson, respected Adams. He felt the new nation needed Adams' skills. And John Ferling says Adams also respected George Washington, even though he thought Washington was not always fair to him. Adams' last public appearance was before cadets from the United States Military Academy at West Point. He was a very old man by then. Someone had to help him walk. And, says historian John Ferling, Adams could not say more than a few sentences.
But what he did in that speech was he exhorted those would-be officers to model themselves on George Washington and called Washington a great man.
Adams' personal weaknesses caused other troubles during his presidency. He belonged to the Federalist Party, but he did not want to become involved in party arguments. And he did not want to make all the compromises necessary in the world of politics. So other Federalists often worked against him. Adams won the presidency in 1796, but his term would be difficult. His own party, the Federalists, did not trust him, and he did not have the support of the general public. The people knew he believed that men of money and position should govern America. Even so, Adams did not expect the job of president to be easy. In politics, he said, a man must always walk on broken glass and red-hot iron. It is not easy to do this when you're not wearing shoes, but some men must do it. There are many dangerous things that have to be done for our country in these dangerous times. If nobody else will do them, he said, he will.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.